Coming up next on Lutheran Radio UK,
The Lutheran Inquisitor, examining pressing issues and their ramifications for the Church today.
Hello and welcome to The Lutheran Inquisitor. I'm your host, John Ehlers. I'm pastor of Christ Lutheran Church in Orpington, Kent, a southeastern suburb of London. I'd like to invite you along to attend one of our services. We have the Divine Service every Sunday morning at 10:30 a.m. I also serve as vacancy pastor for St. Columba Lutheran Church in East Kilbride. They meet each Sunday at 11 a.m. And again, encourage you, if you live in the Glasgow area, to go pay them a visit. If you don't live in any of those areas, why not go to our website, lutheran.co.uk, click on the directory button, find the congregation closest to you, pay them a visit. I know that you'll receive a very warm welcome. We'd like to welcome to the Lutheran Inquisitor Dr. Joel Bierman. He is professor of systematic theology at Concordia Seminary in St. Louis, Missouri. Joel, welcome back to the Lutheran Inquisitor.
Yeah, it's good to be with you guys again.
Thank you for joining us. We're going to talk today about the Sabbath. So can you tell us what that word means? It's not really a word we hear in our daily lives very much anymore. What it means, maybe where it came from?
Sure. Well, I'm going to approach this from a systematic standpoint, which means I get to cheat and say I don't know all the details about exegetical things and I don't have to worry about it. And so that's kind of how I've been thinking about Sabbath quite a bit lately, but in the context of its wider application and what it might mean for our lives as God's people. So Sabbath basically is the name that gets used in the Old Testament for this idea of the seventh day of observance, a day of rest. And so it starts getting called the Sabbath. And that shows up in the Pentateuch already, where you've got the commandments and the laws being handed down. And God establishes that there should be a Sabbath, a day of rest. And that's basically the root of Sabbath comes from this, the Hebrew word for rest. And that's the sense of it. But what's really kind of been grabbing my attention lately and thinking about it is the grounding of Sabbath, not so much just in Mosaic law or as in the law of Israel, but the whole idea of Sabbath as a concept that has a natural law underpinning. And so I'm thinking about this from a systematic standpoint, and all kinds of interesting things start to pop about as far as why Sabbath, what's going on, what it means, and is this just this kind of strange law that Israel had that made Israel distinct? And we all know this, you know, the Sabbath keeping, and how, I mean, Jews to this day are still Orthodox, observant Jews are very strict about Sabbath and what that means and what you can and can't do and all the rules, and we're all quite very familiar with all the rules during Jesus' time. But I'm convinced that there's a lot more going on underneath this, and that in a sense the Sabbath rules and observance are sort of just the application to Israel of a much greater foundational truth, what I would say is a natural law truth wired into the universe. And that's where things get more interesting as far as I'm concerned. So that's kind of just the broad overview of kind of what I'm thinking about and kind of how I'm approaching this.
Okay, so when you say natural law, for some of our folks who are listening who may not know exactly what you mean by that, what do you mean by natural law?
Yeah, that's a good place to start. So natural law is an interesting term because in some circles it gets looked at with disdain and a great deal of suspicion. And that has been the case ever since mid-20th century or so, when Swiss theologian Karl Barth started his rampage against liberalism to some extent. He didn't go far enough perhaps, but he started. And he was greatly concerned about something known as natural religion, which was the idea that man, using all of his brilliant powers and his enlightenment skills, would be able to discern the truths about the world, including the truths about God and religion, without any need for any kind of special revelation from outside. And so natural revelation set about trying to figure out God and figure out everything you need to know about God simply by looking at the world and observing and thinking. And that was the objective of natural religion, which was essentially the liberal academy of the whole late 19th into the early 20th century. And so Karl Barth railed against that, and he hated natural religion. And one of the key tools of natural religion is this thing called natural law, the idea that there are certain rules built into the universe, and they're just there and they're given. And if we study those things, we can learn about the truths of the universe and the truths about how things actually are. And so natural law was seen as a tool of natural religion. And so Karl Barth became very suspicious of it and very, very much negative toward it, and essentially rejected it entirely. And he had no use for natural law. In his opinion, what mattered was God speaking, God revealing himself, God making himself known through revelation, and that preeminently in Jesus Christ. And so any idea of natural law was to him like an end around, and it was dismissing Jesus and dismissing revelation. And so he saw a big contrast between natural law and revelation, had no use for it. Now, the way I approached natural law, and the way I believe St. Paul does, and the way Luther does, and the way most of the reformers did, was to say, no, natural law is simply the plan, the design, the structure that God has built into the very fabric of the universe. And natural law is not at odds with God's revelation, but is in fact a part of God's revelation. And so we have a correspondence between general revelation about the universe, including natural law, and special revelation in Christ. They're not at odds. They're not like against each other. They're not opposed. They're simply quite complementary to one another. Jesus is the fulfillment of all that God has shown us and God is doing. And so when I talk about natural law, what I mean is basically the very rules of the universe, the very design, the shape, the structure of the creation all around us that God has established, that God has built into it. God made the natural law. God is not is not submissive to natural law. He's not somehow has to be obedient to natural law. The natural law does not predate him. He's the supreme being. And so all things come from him. So the natural law is his idea. He establishes it. He's not beholden to it. He does not have to follow the natural law because it's like some laws of the universe. In that case, you'd have natural law being greater than God, which is also why people get suspicious of natural law talk. But if you understand law, and the natural law is simply God's plan that he established, that God the Creator said, this is how it's going to be. And so he creates the world and establishes gravity and the laws of thermodynamics. And he establishes the laws of how families function and the laws of relationships. And all of these are part of the design, the plan, the structure of the universe. All of that becomes natural law. So natural law then is simply the way that things work in the world. And they are there because God has put them there. And that's God's design. So that's a very long answer to a short, quick, easy question, but I think it's important to kind of establish this where I'm coming from and where what we mean by natural law when we say it, because it's really often misunderstood or misconstrued by many people.
Thank you for that. So if I'm understanding you correctly, then you're saying the Sabbath, this rest, is built in by God in creation for humanity, I suppose, for our benefit?
Exactly. This is where you're heading on the right track. And not just for our benefit, but it's got this kind of a wired in foundation. And so that's kind of the whole idea. So we see this in many places. So God creates the world and says, this is how it's going to work. And he creates man and woman. This is the whole story in Genesis 1 and 2. And he creates the man and the woman and he puts them in the garden and they have tasks to do. So Adam's got his work and Eve has her work. And this is all grounded in the creation. And this is all part of the natural law. And it grows up out of the creation itself. And then all kinds of specific applications derive from this. Now, in a similar way with Sabbath, I would argue, is grounded in the very fabric of creation itself. And you see this in Genesis 1, the first of the two creation accounts, because as we all are familiar, the Genesis story gives us two very distinct accounts of creation. You got Genesis 1 through 2, verse 4 or so. And then the second creation account kicks in the second part of Genesis 2, and the first one that gives us the classic, the 6 days of creation on, you know, day one, heavens and the earth were separated, you know, the light from the dark and all the distinction days and then the ornamentation days and that's all Genesis 1. Then Genesis 2 gives us the more kind of anthropocentric or the focused on man account where you have got Adam being created first, and then being put in the garden, and then the animals being created for Adam's sake, and then Eve being created because no other helper was suitable for Adam, and then Eve comes on the scene, and then we have creation complete, and then that leads us into Genesis 3, which then tells the story of the fall. So Genesis 1 and 2 are very distinct in the stories they tell. they are complementary, but they're very distinct in the stories they tell. But Genesis 1 gives us the account of the 6 days where something new is coming on the scene each day, and then something new is being added to those creations, those distinctions that God makes. And as we all know, those 6 days culminate with the 7th day, which is the odd one, because on the 7th day, God rested from all of his creation, the scripture tells us, and he stopped working. Now, what's bizarre about this is, so God rested on the 7th day. Why? He was tired. He needed a breather. I mean, this is absurd. God is omnipotent, creator of everything. God does not need to rest any more than he needs 6 days to get creation done. St. Augustine postulated that God can make the universe in a second. So that's probably what he did. Great, he could, but the scripture tells us what it tells us. And so God created on 6 days. Why? Because he chose to, not because he needed to, but because he chose to. And this is where Dietrich Bonhoeffer, who has been a kind of a significant influence on my thinking, a lot of this, jumps in and is really helpful. In his little book called Creation and Fall, Bonhoeffer contends that the whole point of the creation in the 6 days is to establish a rhythm, the rhythm of the day and the rhythm of the week. And these things are fascinating because these things are just built into the very fabric of creation, Bonhoeffer argues, and I think he's on the right track here. So in other words, God creates in 6 distinct days to establish the pattern of the day and then the pattern of the week. Then the day of the rest on the 7th day is not some sort of anomaly where God's like, whew, worn out, got to take a break here. This is not the case at all. What God's doing is he's saying, this is the whole point of creation. And what's interesting is the word Sabbath does not appear in Genesis 1 or 2. Doesn't appear till later. It just tells us in Genesis 1 that God rested from his labors on the 7th day. And so what we have established there then is this concept of 6 days of activity, 6 days of work and of busyness in the creation for the sake of the creation. And then on this 7th day, a day of rest. But the word here for rest is also interesting because it's not just inactivity. It has the sense of celebration, a sense of observation, a sense of kind of recognizing something going on. In other words, a sense of delighting in something. That's what's going on here with this idea of rest. There's more to it than just inactivity. It really has this idea of a culmination and a fulfillment and of God simply enjoying what's there. And this is all in chapter 2 of Genesis, which, as I said, is actually the tail end of the first creation account. So we have, this is chapter 2, verse 1, thus the heavens and the earth were completed in all their hosts. So it's all done on day 6. And by the 7th day, God completed his work, which he had done, and he rested on the 7th day from all his work, which he had done. And then God blessed the 7th day and sanctified it, because in it he rested from all the work which he had done. So what we get then is this sense of the 7th day being this blessed, sanctified, set-apart day. And it's not there because, this is the day we always rest so that we can get back to work. No, the 7th day actually becomes the culmination, the purpose, the reason, the objective. In other words, all of creation is driving toward the fulfillment of everything being complete. And the 7th day is the day when God says, look, it's complete. This is how it's supposed to be. And then he delights, he celebrates, he rests, he enjoys, he just is a delectable experience. Just, this is it. This is the creation I've made, and now I'm simply enjoying it. And so then we have the established here, then the day and then the week, the 6 days of work and labor and this day of rest, and then the very cycle of the week gets established, and it's all here already in the first creation account in Genesis 1 through the first few verses of chapter 2.
Thank you for that. It's always puzzled me as to why the first 6 days end with, and there was evening and the close of the day and it was good. But on the 7th day, there is no evening. Is that what you're pointing to, where creation is heading toward this, driving toward this, and that's the fulfillment? Or am I just, is my aha moment kind of gone?
No, I think your aha moment is right on track, and I hadn't thought of that aha moment about the lack of an evening there. And I think what you're getting at is precisely my point. which is, I think, the scriptural idea is that the creation is driving for this seventh day, and the seventh day is more than just one more day in the series. It's the whole point. It's the fulfillment. And so in a sense, the idea is that the creation lives in this kind of perpetual reality of Sabbath fulfillment completion. And then you start getting the question of, so when God establishes rules for Israel of Sabbath observance, what he's really doing is he's picking up on this natural law foundation he's built into the universe, and he's giving them a specific way of observing and remembering and keeping this in mind. That's the point. The point is, don't forget what this is all about. Don't forget the point of all this. Don't forget to live in sync. And that's going to be one of my key ideas here, is this kind of idea simply of living in sync with God's creation. And when you're living in sync with God's creation, that's Sabbath. That's what it means to be living in Sabbath. And you're in sync not with just the creation, but also with the Creator, obviously. And that's what it means to be living in Sabbath. That's the delight. That's the kind of the point of the whole thing.
And is that, again, looking ahead to Exodus 20, where you have the Ten Commandments, and you have the remember the Sabbath day and keep it holy, and you shall not do any work, you, your maidservant, your manservant, and again, interestingly enough, your ox, your donkey, and the sojourner among you, because God created on the seventh day and he rested. Again, I find that very interesting, that it almost seems to be that the rest is for those who are most vulnerable, those who are most likely to be exploited, including animals. Again, is that fit into the picture, or am I just dreaming this again?
And see, what I see happening here then is that the kind of the continuity that was growing out of this is, if we understand Sabbath as being part of, it's the very fulfillment, it's what the creation is for. God creates this how it's supposed to be. Now, of course, Genesis 3 brings the whole negative aspect of the fall and how things are out of whack, and then we have the restoration, and then we also have the whole Exodus 20 and the Sinai and the giving of the Decalogue and the giving of all the commandments for Israel. There's a specificity there. Those commandments are given to help Israel to live in sync with God's purposes and to begin to, in a sense, overcome the brokenness of sin. They're heading in that new direction, that restoration. And so there's a continuity here with the Sabbath, but it doesn't exhaust the Sabbath. There's more to it. And I would say that this rules against working are to keep Israel from becoming too dependent on themselves, too focused on what we can accomplish. And yes, the exploitation here of those who are vulnerable, including animals or the poor, everybody benefits from Sabbath. That's the whole point. When creation is working the way it's supposed to, everybody benefits. Everybody delights in the good that God has created.
You've struck something again in my mind. We go back to the fall, and the curse of the fall is you're going to have to really work to produce grain, you know, thorns, thistles, that'll come up, but it's by the sweat of your brow you're going to eat this, the bread, the fruit of your labor. And so Sabbath then becomes a really important part of resting because of the labor.
Yes, exactly. So the labor, and labor itself, this is kind of what's driven a lot of this for me, is I've taught a class a number of times here at the seminary at a grad level called Work and Art. And just thinking about work and examining that from a theological perspective, which is quite fascinating, because it's much more complicated than you'd ever think looking at it from just the outside. You think, well, yeah, you work and you're done. But it's much more interesting what work means and how it fits. And so work was always part of God's intention for creation, for Adam in particular. Adam was built to work. That's what he's created for, and it's not a bad thing. But the fall introduces the negative element of thorns and thistles and the sweat, and you know, and it's painful, it's difficult. And so the good thing that was created is now shot through with sin and brokenness, and it's not nearly as much fun. It's hard. And so then the Sabbath is still there, but it's not what it's supposed to be. It's now been shot through with sin as well, like all the creation has. And so that's why I believe God establishes rules about Sabbath, to help establish that don't forget what this is about, and don't become too dependent on your own work, and don't be so confident in what you're going to accomplish. I want you to be trusting in me. And so, yeah, everything changes with the fall. It brings in this negative element and just twists everything from what it should have been to the kind of mess that we now experience.
So you talk about not relying on yourself and the curse of the fall. Is that where, again, Deuteronomy 5 comes in? You have another account of the giving of the law. But there it's slightly different, the third commandment, because in Exodus 20, it talks about, you know, God, on the seventh day you'll rest because God created the heavens and the earth, and on the seventh day you rested. But in Deuteronomy, it talks about you observe the day because God brought you out of Egypt. You were there slaves. And so how does that fit into the picture?
It is fascinating because you have the two places in the Pentateuch where the Sabbath is specifically commanded and God grounds it in a place. And in Exodus, he grounds it in the creation. And in Deuteronomy, he grounds it in the Exodus of the release from Egypt and the new promised land and the fulfillment. And see, I think this is picking up on the couple of these aspects. So the Exodus account really zeroes in on the creational structure of the universe, the 6 days of creation and the day of rest, that's the fulfillment. And then what Deuteronomy is reminding us of is the whole idea of what's the point of Sabbath? It's being able to live at peace, in sync. And I don't want to get this whole liberty, freedom too much because Westerners hear this and kind of flip out and start going off into an enlightenment direction of nobody tells me what to do, you know, free to be my own person kind of stuff, which is not the intention here at all. But the sense of the whole point of the Exodus is you've been enslaved to Egypt and I'm going to give you the freedom that you're supposed to have when you're living in sync with me and with creation. And that's what Sabbath is. Sabbath is rest. It's living with everything in tune, everything lined up the way it's supposed to be. You're in your place. God's in his place. All the creation around you is doing what it's supposed to do, and you're simply delighting in that stuff. That's what Exodus reestablishes. When the people get into the promised land, it's the promised land. And obviously, there are eschatological overtones to all of this, which is kind of why I get excited about this, that you start seeing the continuity of how this all works out. God creates with a plan for his creation. The fall thwarts that and twists it and distorts it and perverts it. Christ comes and restores the creation back to God's plan, and with his death and resurrection gets things back on track, and that's the whole point of Christ's redemptive work. And then at the eschaton, we see the fulfillment of this, of a new heavens and a new earth. All of creation is put back as God intended, and now we delight in that new recreation, and so it all starts to hang together here. And so the Deuteronomy emphasis on the promised land and no longer under slavery, no longer burdened, is a key aspect of what it means to be living in Sabbath, which means you're no longer underneath the burden of oppression, no longer being subjugated to the imposition of sin and its brokenness.
And in the Old Testament, then, does that filter into the Sabbath year, the seventh year, where slaves, and even the year of Jubilee, slaves are set free, debts forgiven. And again, is that fellowship, again, not only with God, but with your brothers and sisters, your family?
Precisely. See, this is, and you're seeing how this all kind of just hangs together rather remarkably and rather obviously when you start just thinking about it this way. So Sabbath rules are not just tick boxes, you know, check, 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 got that done, tick off the items as you do them in your list. That's not how this is working. It's this learning to live in sync with God's purposes. So you're right, the seventh year of, you know, freedom from debts, and then the Jubilee year where all things are restored and land is restored, it's you're back in sync with one another, not just with God, but with all of creation. We're living the way God intended, and we're living in that Sabbath reality. So this is where things get fascinating to me and really interesting, because so what does this mean for us as Christians? This means as Christians, Sabbath is not just, oh, you can't do anything on Sunday, or don't mow your lawn on Sunday, don't put the washout on Sunday or Saturday if you happen to be a Saturday Sabbatarian and you're having that debate. That's missing the whole point. The point is not just following this rule or that rule. The point is living in the reality of the natural law, truth of Sabbath, which is this is what God created this for. You're supposed to be living this in tune with God's purposes and delighting in God's purposes. And when we're living that way, that's Sabbath living. And it's much more interesting than simply rules about what you can or can't do on a certain day.
So if we go then to the New Testament, we see Jesus, he gets in all kinds of trouble with the religious leaders about the Sabbath. He heals people on the Sabbath. The disciples are plucking heads of grain on the Sabbath. Why did he get in so much trouble? And what does he have to say about the Sabbath that helps us understand understand its relation to how we live in harmony with God and one another.
Right, right, yeah. And this is good. The quality of living in harmony with God and one another, that's a nice way of putting it. You know, I'm using this phrase in sync, but the in harmony is even better. And this is exactly what we see Jesus doing. We see Jesus celebrating the natural law reality of what Sabbath means and pushing against all the piles up of laws that had been built up, even in addition to the simple Pentateuch laws of don't work, and now you have all the rabbinical laws trying to explain exactly what that means, what qualifies as work and what doesn't, and you get all the crazy rules that were in place in Christ's day during the Second Temple Judaism, which were overwhelmingly constraining and missing the whole point of Sabbath. And so you see Jesus thwarting this. So what does he do? He heals on the Sabbath, because what is healing? It's the restoration of the creation back in sync with God's purposes. And so what Jesus is doing, he's actually fulfilling and doing Sabbath by bringing about the fulfillment. And of course, in the eyes of the Pharisees, he's violating the rules, and so therefore he can't possibly be godly or a from God, because he doesn't keep the rules. But the rules are the ones they've created, not the ones God has established. So what we see Jesus doing is actually overturning things. And see, when you see the disciples plucking grain and eating, they're simply taking care of their needs, and they're not doing anything that violates God's plan. And when Jesus heals, it's even more deliberate. You see the brokenness of sin, which is anti-Sabbath, and Jesus overcomes the brokenness of sin and the pain of suffering and of disease and the disease processes, and he undercuts them by bringing about the healing that God had intended, and he's actually bringing people back into Sabbath relations so they can live a Sabbath way in the brokenness of the world. So Jesus is actually showing us what it means to keep Sabbath. It's not a matter of rules, it's a matter of delighting in what God has done.
And you've touched on it, but how does this then, this Sabbath or this rest, it's talked about in Hebrews 4. How does that actually then fulfill, and how can we look forward to that in the future? I mean, when people talk about, oh, I'm going to be with God and it'll be a wonderful place, most people think, ah, that's boring. It sounds horrible. But what is a Sabbath rest or eternal rest? I suppose we often hear it called after death and eternity with Christ.
Right. And so that's where you get the Hebrews thing, there remains a Sabbath rest for the people of God, which does not mean you better maintain your Sabbath rules and you've got to keep on doing your seventh day, not working. And I've heard some Christian people interpret the Hebrews text that way, which is really odd to me, that, well, Hebrews proves we still have to keep the laws about Sabbath, and so you can't do your laundry on the Sunday or Saturday, whichever day you want to debate about. Which is missing the whole point. When the writer to Hebrews says a Sabbath rest remains, what he's saying is, you bet, there's a fulfillment yet to come, and we're looking forward to this, and this is the whole reason Christ came, is to bring us into this Sabbath reality, this fullness of God's plan, and this remains for us. That's the eschatological fulfillment. And so when we see it this way, we recognize that Sabbath is not, as I said, a cessation from labor, but it's labor in the right way. It's everything's in tune. It's the way it's happening. So I believe the way to understand it is not that you have 6 days, work hard, then catch your breath on the seventh day and rest. Okay, back to working hard for 6 days, catch your breath. And nowadays, of course, we have a 5-day work week. It's even more comfortable for most of us, and there's even talk about a 4-day work week, but it's still missing the point. The point is that the Christian lives rightly related to the creation around, rightly related to God. That's what it means to be living in Sabbath. And so when we think about the eschatological implications of this, the eschaton, the fulfillment, the new heavens and new earth, is not endless church service, and it's not sitting around doing nothing. It's actually being quite active in doing what God created you to do in the right relationship with the creation, in the right relationship with the Creator, and enjoying those good gifts and enjoying those relationships. That's Sabbath fulfillment. That's what we look forward to as God's people.
Dr. Behrman, in just the last few minutes we have, we live in a world, it seems to me, that is just, you know, longing and begging for rest and for peace. I mean, what words of encouragement would you have even for Christians who are, you know, weary and heavy laden, as Jesus said? What words of peace, encouragement, comfort do you have for those who are struggling to find this sort of rest, particularly in our pandemic-ridden world today?
Yeah, there are a couple of things we can unpack even more here, but just the quick word is that the rest comes when you're in Christ. This is the whole point. This is what the Hebrew writer of Hebrews is saying. This is the whole point of the New Testament, that this rest, this right relationship with God and creation will never happen apart from Christ. Christ is the fulfillment. Christ is the means to finding the right relationship with God, obviously, and with all of creation. So when Christ restores us to God's plan, we're restored not only with our Creator, but with the creation around us. And that's when rest begins. So it's not just an attitudinal thing, sort of like, you know, a Buddhist, get your head right about suffering and get your desires lined up. It's much more than this. It's knowing who you are, knowing where you fit in creation, and knowing that God is in control. Your future and your security don't depend on yourself. It's God who's going to care for you. It's God who provides. It's God who brings about the Sabbath fulfillment. That's where the rest begins to become a present reality. And it's always going to be just sort of, you know, a foretaste, a little tease. There's more to come, and we know that. So we don't have it fully and complete now. It's coming, but we will get it, and we know that as well. And so that's where the comfort comes in, is we know that God has promised to restore, and He will, and we count on Him. So we start to have tastes of the rest now, not because life suddenly becomes better and God just provides for every need immediately, but because we have a different understanding of our role and of God's promise and how those things fit together.
Dr. Bierman, we thank you for helping us to better understand this often misunderstood and oftentimes neglected idea of the Sabbath in the Scriptures. We do thank you, and we pray God's richest blessings for you. Again, thank you for helping us understand the Sabbath and all the rest.
My pleasure.
Thank you for listening to the Lutheran Inquisitor with Pastor John Ehlers. If you have any questions or comments about the issues raised in this program, send an email to info@lutheranradio.co.uk. The podcast of this show is available from our website. Check our program online and stay tuned.